ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more. You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good afternoon. Elsie Adamo with you here today, filling in for Selena Green, who's on the sick list. And we do hope you feel better soon, Selena. But plenty to get through today. In a moment, we'll be getting an update from Meat and Livestock Australia on their annual updates conference, which is on in Adelaide. Also in the next half hour, there's huge global demand for fertiliser. So why has one of Australia's biggest proposed potash projects been canned? And the ABS quarterly production figures for red meat are in.
The biggest headlines that we're seeing from this data is Australia is continuing to produce record beef. This quarter, we saw over 750,000 tonnes of beef produced, which is well and truly the most we've ever done in 3 months. It's really exciting.
You'll hear more on those figures soon. But first, today, conditions right now are generally improving for our livestock producers. So now is a good time as any to take stock and plan ahead. Meat and Livestock Australia update event is on in Adelaide today, where over a dozen speakers will be sharing some of the latest insights from the organisation and what farmers need to be thinking and planning for in the months to come. MLA Managing Director Mick Crowley joins us now from the event. Good afternoon, Mick. Thanks for making the time to join us on the Country Hour today.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
So what's turnout been like today for the event?
We've been really pleased with the turnout. We've got around 500 livestock producers attending our updates forum today, which is just fantastic. And I've met people from every state and territory that have all travelled here to Adelaide for today's event.
So you spoke this morning about Meat and Livestock Australia's vision for the future. Can you actually share what some of MLA's plans are for the months and years ahead?
It's a really exciting time when we are launching and really bringing to life our strategic plan that shapes where we need to get to by 2030. And we're very focused on productivity and profitability, underpinning long-term sustainability and prosperity for our sector. So I've been unpacking our strategy that covers our net zero ambitions that line up with the national agenda, driving value-based marketing, increasing demand, building social capital, delivering multi-breed genetic evaluation and investing in our people. And that really is shaped by the operating environment, which demand for red meat globally, including our domestic market, is in very good shape. So it's a very strong position that we're in and really focused on how we bring that plan to life.
So this year's theme is towards 2030, driving prosperity through productivity, sustainability and value capture. How's Meat and Livestock Australia as an organisation working towards some of those different goals?
One of the big approach changes that we've made is we've done some fantastic work in our R&D investments across genetics, on-farm productivity, feed base, feedlot, processing efficiency, and our marketing campaigns, both domestically and internationally. And the big opportunity is to operate more collaboratively as a supply chain, looking at where we can create and capture more value at each step in the chain that will ultimately deliver more value to our livestock producers, our levy payers. And that the culture of the industry is such that we've been had such positive conversations about the willingness for the industry to continue to mature and evolve in that space so that we can overcome volatility, have more certainty around market conditions. But there's a lot of work to do, and but we can do that in partnership with the sector.
Well, yeah, there has been, good volatility in a way that the tariffs were dumped on Aussie beef this week or over the weekend. Has that come up in discussions much today? Is it something that have been on people's minds?
Trade has dominated the operating environment, and the tariff situation has certainly led to some, I guess we haven't been as impacted as other countries, but it creates uncertainty. So we've benefited from improved access into other markets that have taken retaliatory measures against the US, and the US remains our largest export market for beef, for lamb and for goat meat. So we've been very lucky. Our sector's been very resilient, but things can change very quickly. So those opportunities can turn into headwinds should things go the other way. So we're very conscious of trying to stay ahead of those issues and reinforce our partnerships with our key customers around the world in those volatile times.
Now, your event is in Adelaide this year, and as you said earlier, there are people from all over the country that have come out, but here in South Australia, it hasn't been the easiest couple of years for our farmers and graziers. I can see a bit of a theme with the program today is resilience and future planning, always important topics for farmers, but I imagine especially important for our farmers here in South Australia considering the last few years.
Absolutely, and you know, discussing the challenges in South Australia, it's been the two driest years on record. The good news is that there is green shoots. You know, parts of the state have are feeling more confident about the season ahead. What has also helped create a positive environment is that livestock prices are heading in the right direction and allowing people to get back into business and restock perhaps faster than they have in the past, just given the outlook being so strong. Certainly really tough conditions to work through for any livestock producer, and South Australia has just had such a bad run. It's always encouraging when people have a longer-term view. We play a long game. It's part of doing business, working through challenging climatic conditions. And, yeah, I guess it does reinforce how do we learn from those challenges, how does the sector respond. We've certainly seen a lot of growth in the feedlot sector, in cattle and a lot of confinement feeding and feeding systems around, you know, staying in production in lamb. So I think our industry is getting better at, you know, managing those seasonal fluctuations. But yeah, by God, it's been certainly very, very tough down here.
Thanks for your time on a busy day, Mick, joining us for the Country Hour. I appreciate it.
Thanks very much for having me. Great to be here.
Mick Crowley, MLA Managing Director, who is in Adelaide today for the MLA Update, which, as Mick said, is hosting people within the livestock industry from across the country. And we're actually going to be sticking with the MLA for a little bit longer. Australia is continuing to turn off huge amounts of beef at high prices, according to the latest data from the Australian Bureau of Statistics. The data released today shows a huge trade in beef, but a different story for sheep and lamb. Erin Lukey, Senior Market Information Analyst from Meat and Livestock Australia, looks at the details.
Yeah, we just received the quarterly slaughter and production figures for red meat from the ABS, which shows some really exciting things. I think the biggest headlines that we're seeing from this data is Australia is continuing to produce record beef. This quarter, we saw over 750,000 tonnes of beef produced, which is well and truly the most we've ever done in 3 months. It's really exciting, 6% up on last year.
And Australia clearly has the capacity to continually turn off more beef.
Yeah, we just keep growing. So it's for the past 12 months, we've consistently capped that record. We've got the number of cattle coming through to be processed staying really high, but what's really pushing it is carcass weights. They're staying really elevated. We've got more animals going through feedlots, more grain-fed production, and then that's what's really pushing that beef production up.
Just in terms of the kill of Australian cattle going up and the amount of beef we're producing going up with it, what does that mean for the herd size and the amount of sort of females we're keeping to breed more cattle?
Yeah, look, so we look at the herd size movements from a female slaughter perspective. So for the last couple of quarters, we've seen female slaughter stay relatively elevated. What we've seen is the herd has been able to consistently produce those cows and turn off those cows. So while female slaughter is still at 53%, the herd is staying relatively stable. We've got a lot of demand for, I guess, that lean trim from the US and such, which is pulling a lot of those females off. But we're finding the productivity of the herd has lifted to combat that. And, yeah, MLA forecasting a relatively stable herd going forward.
So that's really interesting, the old numbers of what percentage a female kill would be at and what that meant for the herd might be changing. We might be keeping more animals alive and being able to breed more from less.
Yeah, so traditionally we looked at a 47% female kill as that turnover, as that herd coming back a bit. But we're seeing, especially for the last sort of 2 years, that female kill has been high, but we've been able to sustain where we are with the herd, where we are with turnoff, and I think it just speaks to that productivity and capability growth.
So further increase in cattle being slaughtered, further increase in beef production. Take me to sheep and mutton. What's happening there? Is that a different story?
A very different story. So when we look at the cattle numbers, they've been really driven by this positive northern season. In the south, it's a different story. We've got harsh conditions impacting producers. So for lamb kill and production, we've seen around an 18% decline on the same time last year, which when you look at it in terms of long term, we're still turning off really good numbers, but compared to last year, we have come back quite significantly.
Is that seasonal related? Obviously, Victoria last year were in the grip of a drought. We had a real failed spring and a lot of numbers were going through abattoirs down here. Is that tied to these numbers?
For sure. So we've had around 18 months, 2 years of pretty harsh conditions, which have impacted producers' lamb cohorts. So while that core breeding flock, we know producers have held on, but the lambs coming off of them are lower because of these poor seasonal conditions. So we are expecting, once conditions do start to improve, we're not sure when that will be, outlooks are looking average, but we are confident that the flock will rebuild.
Lamb meat production and lambs being slaughtered, both down by double digits.
Yeah, definitely.
So that's a big movement. Does it often move by that far?
Lamb is very seasonal. It's not unexpected to see these kind of numbers because it's got a lamb is under 12 months old, so you see these kind of leaps and bounds. So it's not out of the ordinary.
Erin Lukey, Senior Market Information Analyst from Meat and Livestock Australia, speaking there to Warwick Long.
Spend an hour in the life of someone else.
That's one small step for a man.
Right, we'll leave the moon there when we'll go to Randwick for the second leg of the double.
Conversations, this morning from 11 on ABC Radio.
And keeping on with meat, United States meat processing and trading company Cargill this month upped its stakes from 50% to full ownership of Australia's second largest beef producer, Tees. Now, the Tees headquarters is at 8 Mile Plains in Brisbane, and the company employs more than 4,800 staff across 14 sites in 4 states, of course, including here in South Australia. Sean Layton is the Global Senior Vice President of Food Safety, Quality and Regulatory Affairs for Cargill. And while he didn't disclose the sale price, he tells Jennifer Nichols the aim is to grow the business.
We've been in partnership with Tees Beef for, I think, over 15 years now. Joint venture partnership, hand in hand with Tees, to produce high quality, safe beef throughout Australia and beyond. And just this week, we closed a deal to take on full ownership of the Tees operation. Cargill, I think, is keen on growing in the Australia region. And so, you know, acquiring it fully is a logical next step, I think. Tees has been an incredible operation for a very, very long time, family owned, values driven. I visited one of their operations Monday this week. And I walked in the door, and within 15 seconds, I thought to myself, of course, this is the natural acquisition for Cargill, because on the wall is things like putting people first, doing the right thing, even if it economically doesn't make sense, you know. And I think Tees values those high integrity ideas, and Cargill does as well. And so it's been a really natural fit.
And yeah. What sort of money did that involve in the investment?
As a food safety leader, I wasn't involved in the capital or the investment side of things, but the capital that Cargill put into it, I'm sure, was, you know, fair and sizable. But we hope to grow it.
And where are the facilities based?
All across Eastern Australia. To that, they have some pretty sizable distribution centers and warehouses scattered up and down, you know, Eastern Australia. So you've got 14 locations, 3 feedlots, 6 beef processing plants, you know, cow into steaks and the initial cuts. two food manufacturing facilities, which is the value add, the further processing, whether it's grind or some other value added, you know, things we can do with the protein. A hide processing site, so just the skins, just the hide of the cattle, and a centralized distribution facility. One of the fascinating things about Tees and the Australian beef market is the length of their supply chains. They, you know, they've got, you know, over 130 days of shelf life on product. They ship all over the world. They supply, of course, Australia, New Zealand, Southeast Asia, Japan. They also supply to Europe, which is a fascinating, and they supply some specialty cuts to Brazil. The Brazilians like a certain culotte. You may have heard of a culotte cut, which is sort of the end cap of the rump. It's sort of a Brazilian delicacy. So we Tees sends a lot of that cap, that culotte cut to Brazil. So they export more out of Australia than we do out of the U.S.
Isn't that fascinating?
It is fascinating.
Is that a slow cook portion of beef? Is that how they treat it?
Yeah. The culotte in Brazil? Yeah. I've made it two or three times myself. It's got a big fat cap on it, and if you slow cook it, it sort of melts over the beef, giving it some extra flavor and savory. Mm,
sounds delicious.
Yeah, it sounds delicious, doesn't it? It's making me hungry thinking about it. Where I was brought in, I've been with Cargill for 9 years. The partnership went beyond my tenure at Cargill. So we've had various food safety leaders, including myself, come in and meet with the Tees team, review their processes and systems from a food safety side over the years. And we have incredible confidence in what they're doing from a food safety perspective, from a compliance perspective. They're the best.
And Tees headquarters has been at 8 Mile Plains in Brisbane. And what's Cargill's history, the company?
The history of the organization?
Yeah.
Oh, we're over 160 years old. Started in the Midwest of the United States. If you analyze the various demographics of the U.S. and the cultures of the U.S., the Midwest, Minnesota, Iowa, Wisconsin is incredibly humble, hardworking agriculture sector. Our start was basically storing grain for farmers and realized that while storing it, we could also make some money by trading the future value of that grain. So wheat today is worth a different price than wheat will be in December. And getting some insights on what's going to happen to the future value of that allows us to either sell that wheat today or sell it in the future and make an extra buck. It doesn't hurt anybody. Those are the natural fluctuations of the market. And Cargill got its start basically trading the futures of certain food commodities like that. Yeah.
What commodities are you trading in now?
Just about everything. I mean, we've got a huge trading floor. If you were able to visit Cargill's headquarters, there's a huge trading floor in the middle of our headquarters building where we're trading everything from traditional food commodities like soybeans and wheat and corn to biodiesel and various precious metals and heavy metals. So anything where we feel like we have some insight into the market and where it's going to go, we'll try to trade because we're very good at it.
And who owns the company?
It's a privately held company owned by the Cargill families, and it's, you know, it's growing sort of a family tree of the McMillans and others, but it's still held by the Cargill family, sort of broadly. Family members sit on our board, so they direct the direction of the company, along with some other, you know, CEOs of various organizations. But yeah, they're still very much involved in the direction of the company, where we invest, where we don't invest, heavily involved.
You wouldn't be able to say that about many companies to have that longevity, yeah, and also still the family involvement.
Yeah. And it could be part of why the Tees Cargill relationship works well, because Tees is very, very similar. You know, family owned, very hands on. There's family members still working for the operation today. So, you know, very, very similar backgrounds and histories.
Sean Layton, Global Senior Vice President of Food Safety Quality and Regulatory Affairs for Cargill, speaking with Jennifer Nichols.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
23 minutes past 12. Now, before we get into the weather, despite the fact there's been huge global demand for fertiliser, one of Australia's biggest proposed potash projects has been canned. For years, a company called Agrimin has been planning to mine sulphate of potash from Lake Mackay on the Northern Territory Western Australian border. The company once valued the project to be worth $1 billion if it made it to the production stage. But the company recently announced it's withdrawing from the project after a review found the development to be, quote, uneconomic. Analyst Peter Stakren says it's not surprising but disappointing given how much fertiliser Australia imports.
It's not unexpected. 5-6 years ago, we had a number of companies looking to develop salts for potash. That's the sulfate of potash, which is used as a fertilizer. And it was all looking fairly promising. The price of sulfate of potash was rising, and the feasibility studies looked fairly positive. And then we had a number of projects actually start up and really fail technically to achieve the results that they thought they would be able to get. So moving from the sort of laboratory or the benchtop scale to a full-scale production was more challenging than these people had actually estimated. And then during the at the beginning of the Russia's invasion of the Ukraine, the price of fertilizers generally really shot up dramatically, and sulfate of potash prices went up over $1,000 a ton from about $200 a ton. But since 2022, the price has really fallen right back. In the meantime, AgriMin has suffered rising capital costs, and of course, the ability of people to finance this, to provide equity and or debt, has really diminished because they've seen the prices for the product falling, and they've seen obviously capital costs rising, but more importantly, they've seen a number of projects actually fall over, and they're going, well, why would we want to support a project like that, which has got so much technical and also market risk.
So why do you think those earlier potash projects failed in the beginning? What were the main reasons for that?
Well, I think the technology didn't work. These are complex salts. You have to isolate the potash from the sodium chloride and any other salts that are in the player, the salt player. And they thought that they could do that efficiently, and they weren't able to produce a product of sufficient quality in the quantities that were required to really cover their operating costs of the project. So it was really, I think they were just hyped up by the idea, and they thought that the price would just continue to run, and you know, they were beaten, you know, by the market effectively.
So do you think this is a sign that potash production in WA is dead in the water?
For the moment it is. I would like to see some of these projects get up, because Australia is a net importer of these products, both all sorts of, whether it's urea for potassium-based fertilisers or for phosphate-based fertilisers. We import most of the products that we use, and it would be really good from a logistical point of view and from a security of supply point of view if we could get domestic production to stand up.
What do you think would need to happen in order to make that come to fruition, though?
Well, we'd have to see a little bit more science involved in how to treat these salt players so that they don't run into the same sort of technical problems. And, you know, maybe someone will come up with a cleverer way of basically refining the salts to get the pure concentrate of potassium sulfate that the market wanted. I mean, there's the Pivot project in Queensland, which is really, Incitec Pivot has basically sold out of its fertilizer business to Ridley, but Ridley's only going to take on the supply side, the distribution side, and they'll be importing product and distributing it through their distribution channels. They're not going to take on the role of mining, as I think that project is basically running out of resources in northern Queensland. So, you know, I think we'd need a bit more exploration and a bit more targeting of likely candidates to be useful products. I mean, there are byproducts. You could also, in some of these players, have lithium in the salts as well, and there's also aluminium that could be refined. So maybe if they had a multi-product, you know, producing high-quality refined alumina and lithium salts as well as potassium salts, that would be a way of having a three-pronged approach.
Corporate analyst Mita Strachan speaking to Georgia Hargraves. It's 29 past 12 on the Country Hour today, well past the time to get into the weather. Chris Kent from the Weather Bureau joins us. Afternoon, Chris.
Hello, how are you going?
Doing well. There's actually a bit of sunshine here where I am in Mount Gambier for the first time in a while. But how are things looking across the rest of the state?
Yeah, we've got a little bit of sunshine across a bit of sunshine, down in the south. Some, still a little bit of cloud around streaming up in the southwesterly sort of airstream, but a few sunny patches here and there. Across the north, we've got pretty clear and sunny conditions. I'm getting a bit warm in the far north, but we do have a little bit of higher cloud starting to stream over from the west, and that's the start of some unsettled weather that we're expecting over the course of the weekend and into next week. We do have a trough of low pressure near the WA border, and that's triggering some showers and thunderstorms, which are expected to move into the western parts of the state throughout the course of this afternoon, probably more likely moving into the northwest pastoral and west coast districts this evening and continuing into the overnight period. Remaining dry and sort of sunny across the rest of the state for today. On Friday, those showers and thunderstorms are going to continue to move across the west and reach the Eyre Peninsula during the afternoon, and we could potentially see some of those thunderstorms become severe in the far west, west of probably around Nullarbor and up into the northwest pastoral. Damaging winds and potential for some large hail and heavy rainfall on the or possibilities with some of those storms out that way. There's a trough that continues to push across on Saturday, and that'll bring showers and thunderstorms to the most of the rest of the state, apart from the northeast pastoral, should remain sort of reasonably clear on Saturday. But showers and thunderstorms pushing sort of across the south. On Sunday, we see a little bit of a clearance in some of that shower and thunderstorm activity. Still, maybe a little bit out in the west, but that's ahead of another trough, which is forecast to move across on Monday, which will bring another round of showers and thunderstorms to large parts of the state from Monday, Tuesday, and maybe even into Wednesday next week. So, a bit of unsettled weather. Unfortunately, sort of the rainfall wise is going to be sort of a bit more hit and miss kind of a scenario where some areas will get some good rainfall and others might miss out. But we are looking at over the next 4 days around 2 to 5 millimetres about the northwest pastoral, increasing 5 to 15 millimetres about the west coast and the Flinders districts, as well as the agricultural areas of SA. And with thunderstorms, we could see totals up towards around 15 to 30 millimetres in parts, particularly in the west, where I mentioned earlier. So, a little bit of rainfall. As well as the rain, we are expecting temperatures to start increasing as well. So from tomorrow, we could see temperatures starting to reach or get into the 40s across the far north of SA. And by Sunday, could see some locations reaching mid-40s. So those warm temperatures, we may see sort of some heat wave warnings as well come out for northern parts of the state over the next couple of days as that heat sort of, continues to build. We will see temperatures starting to get into the 30s across southern parts of the state as well, which we haven't seen so far in November. In Adelaide in particular, we've struggled sort of to reach 30 at all yet. So we might see our first day above 30 over the weekend. So that's, I think, about all we've got. Elsie?
Yeah, well, that's plenty, I think. Chris, plenty for everyone to keep an eye on. Thanks for joining us.
No worries. Thank you very much.
That was Chris Kent from the Weather Bureau. And let's take a look at the Western Inland. In the Upper Western District, sunny morning, chance of a thunderstorm in the northeast in the afternoon and evening, winds south to southeasterly. Overnight temperatures will be falling between 15 to 21 and daytime temperatures expected to reach between 32 and 38. And in the Lower Western District, mostly sunny, winds south to southeasterly, becoming light in the late evening. Overnight temperatures falling between 8 and 13 degrees, with daytime temperatures reaching between 27 to 32.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Elsie Adamo with you here today for the Country Hour, sitting in the chair for Selena Green, who is on the sick list. Now, in a moment, we'll be talking about the CSIRO, who does important work here in Australia from helping our landscape stay healthy, creating new energy solutions and keeping pest numbers down. Their research often helps those living on the land, but this week it was announced it will slash up to 350 jobs in an attempt to reduce costs. So what research will they be prioritising? And also, another round of buybacks is on the way for the Southern Murray-Darling Basin. You'll hear why a Riverland water broker is concerned of how it could impact the region. And also in this next half hour, here's a bit of a cheeky question for you on your Thursday afternoon. Would you get your gear off for a good cause?
Most people were pretty good. A few people took a little bit of convincing, but once we told them sort of where the funds are going to and what goes in, it all goes back into our community, all the stuff 100%. So everyone was pretty happy in the end and was all taken very tastefully.
You'll hear about a group of farmers on the Eyre Peninsula doing just that. But before we get to all those great stories, we better check in on the news headlines. Bethany Alderson joins us. Good afternoon, Bethany.
Good afternoon, Elsie. The Prime Minister says Australia will still play a key role in next year's major UN climate summit after confirming Adelaide will not hold the event. Australia and Turkey Air had been jostling to host COP31, and if a resolution had not been found, the event would have been hosted in Germany. Anthony Albanese says Turkey Air will host COP31, but Climate Change Minister Chris Bowen will handle the negotiations. Independent Narunga MP Fraser Ellis says new mining laws ignore the concerns of farmers in favour of supporting mining companies. SA's Parliament has amended laws to allow the mining minister to extend 18-year leases given to companies when starting projects. The minister, Tom Koutsantonis, says the changes would only be used when necessary. And Nearstar has successfully cast antimony metal from its pilot plant at the Port Pirie smelter site. Earlier this year, the plant was handed a $135 million rescue package from the federal, SA and Tasmanian governments so it could improve its facilities and process critical minerals. The company, which owns the Port Pirie lead smelter, was losing tens of millions of dollars a month. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thanks, Bethany. That was Bethany Alderson with your news headlines. A Riverland water broker says irrigation trusts are likely to lose a lot of water in the next round of buybacks. The Federal Water Minister last week announced a program for the voluntary purchase of 130 gigalitres of water from the Southern Murray-Darling Basin, drawing from previous EOIs. Of the 1,020 responses, 171 are from South Australia. Tom Rooney, Chief Executive Officer of Waterfind, says it's too early to see the impact of water markets, but there's an uptick in demand interest to buy permanent water.
The temporary market really hasn't been reacted adversely or been any sort of major changes in the temporary market pricing. So that really hasn't reacted to this. And the permanent market, the way that that occurs is that trades are recorded in registers, and those registers record the value and volumes of transactions. Now, the way that the registers work, it unfortunately takes at the moment some point of time, which is often months, for those registers to record the trades. So you'd say recording through registers and what is occurring, it's too early to say at the moment how the market's reacted to this announcement. However, being, you know, on the ground as far as in the market is concerned, and in the industry, it's sort of being wildly, it's being discussed that there was an uptick in demand interest. So those people that were maybe sitting on their hands a little bit to buy a permanent parcel of water, it might have been, the announcement might have been enough to sort of tip them into the market to say, okay, well, I better do something now before the Commonwealth comes in. So they sort of brought forward a purchase decision. So that's sort of what has been anecdotally reported through the market, but that hasn't been reflected yet in the registers because it's too early for the registers to show that sort of behaviour yet.
What sort of conversations are you having at the moment as a water market broker? Are you been speaking with government about this announcement, and what sort of next steps are there?
Yes, we're talking to a lot of clients. Obviously, they call us and say, what does this mean? And can I sell my water to the government? To be clear on that, first of all, we sort of need to wait. It's for those people that have got existing expressions of interest in under EOI 1, which they would have lodged by November 24. That's the parcels now they're coming to the marketplace a year on to then say, okay, we might make you an offer. So look out for future correspondence that might be coming there. Now, if you have not put in an EOI in relation to the EOI 1 November 24, you will not get an opportunity under that program to resubmit to the Commonwealth. Under EOI 2, that was for the large water purchases or large water offers, which were 20 gigalitres and more, that they're expanding that program. So there's not many people that have those types of volumes of water. So that the handful of people that have put under that program that haven't heard yet in relation to their the government's position on whether they're buying that or not will most likely hear soon. In relation to that, yes, we are always engaging with government and asking them questions about things. So the questions really are around the clarification of how that 130 gigalitres is going to be operational in the marketplace. Does it affect the total number or not? Is it within the 450 buyback targets at the moment? And how does this affect the SIDLAM numbers? And are the SIDLAM numbers going to, which is the shortfall in relation to engineering projects that has been widely reported, is that going to be coming in from to the marketplace demand as well? So that's sort of the questions that we're asking at the moment.
There's been a continued concern, especially from irrigation trusts, about losing water from the from irrigation trusts. Is there actually many clients really in that position that would be selling water that you're aware of?
I think the short answer to that is yes. Certainly the irrigation trust clients in certain areas often have permanent sort of more higher security water rights in some areas of the basin. There's other trusts that are set up which have got lower reliability or general security water rights. The nature of those trusts is it does have a heavy, some of them have a heavy contingent of wine grape growers, which we all know and has been widely reported just how hard that industry is at the moment. And a lot of people in that industry are probably, you know, I suppose you would say that almost not willing sellers, they're more desperate sellers. They're looking for ideas and opportunities to help keep their businesses afloat while they continue to grapple with the tough decisions around whether they stay in the industry, go through the major expense and efforts to do crop change, negotiating with their banking partners about how. So it's certainly, I think we'll find that the trusts will be a heavy contingent in relation to both this EOI 1, not so much the EOI 2, the large water sale program, but the EOI 1 program. I think there'll be a heavy contingent of irrigation trust members that would have put a proposal in there.
And I guess it's not surprising to hear, yeah, about the trusts. I mean, we're hearing prices of $80 a tonne and advice from wineries coming in about, yeah, ripping out grapes. So I guess people looking for said capitals for their business to either diversify or look after things. Yeah, it's definitely an option people are looking at.
I think it's a real issue that we need to think about strongly because, you know, we need to think about the future, the next generation. I'm not even talking about 20 or 50 years' time. I'm talking about 3 or 5 years' time. What happens if we have this mass exodus of water out of our trusts and I think it's a real issue that we need to be very careful about, because there's major infrastructure, major towns and industries around this. And, you know, I grew up in one of those trust areas and was a previous member of a trust as well. And, you know, my old district has changed substantially already. And I think it puts other pressures through about, is it a growing district now or is it a rural living district? And what do we do as far as local planning rules are concerned? Is water ever going to be coming back into the areas as well? I think there's, I know we've got a tough environment that we're in there now, but we kind of need to have it. I think we desperately need a plan right now about how in trust regions we're going to be dealing with this.
Tom Rooney, Chief Executive Officer of Waterfine, speaking with Eliza Berlage. You're listening to the Country Hour. Elsie Adamo with you here today. It's coming up to 1:45. Now, the CSIRO has announced it will slash up to 350 jobs as the National Science Agency grapples with long-term financial challenges. The organisation said it has reached a, quote, critical inflection point, with funding failing to keep pace with the rising costs of running a modern science agency. Chief Executive Dr. Doug Hilton spoke to James Glenday on the ABC about what areas might be cut and what they would prioritise.
That's right. Over the last 18 months, for probably the first time in decades, we've looked at the whole research portfolio of CSIRO. And we've asked about the areas that we think the organisation could be uniquely placed to make the best possible contribution to Australia's future. So going through that process, we've identified areas that we will focus on and areas that, as you say, will deprioritise. Mm.
So nutrition is one that has been given as an example. Are there any other broader areas you can tell us about where research is going to be cut back?
We certainly want to focus on One Health, so that intersection between the environmental health, agricultural health and community health. And we'll do that in areas like our response to pathogens. So we have a facility in Geelong called ACDP, which is our Level 4 containment facility, and there's a lot of work done there on pathogens and invasive species that affect the whole of our country.
If you had more money from the federal government, would you be making these cuts?
The organisation over 100 years has always focused its research in different ways. The science we're doing now is very different to the science we were doing 50 years ago. So there's always going to be a need to refine the skills of our workforce to be able to change direction. I think that's something the Australian community would expect us to do. Science is never static. It always evolves. It always changes. It builds on discoveries that have been previously made. So we always need to be nimble.
You've sort of skillfully talked around my question there. I think people watching would simply ask, if you had more money, would you do more research? I mean, would you be making these cuts if you had more federal funding?
We would always make changes, but of course, if we were given more appropriation, there's a lot more science to do. And I think the government's aware of that. It's announced some months ago the strategic examination of research and development in Australia. So I think it understands that trajectory of science in Australia is really important for our future. Mm-hmm. And a great example of that is, you know, we've talked a lot about how we turn our critical minerals wealth into critical materials for manufacturing. That happens because of great science, and we need to do the science to make those processes clean and green.
What is going to be the priority now for the CSIRO, and how should we judge the success of a restructure like this, which is going to cause a lot of internal angst? Are we looking at breakthroughs, certain KPIs that you're going to be setting for these priority areas?
Yeah, so we're looking across all of our research. We have some fantastic programs that have delivered great benefits over 20, 30 years, things like the work in agriculture to make our industry more sustainable and more productive. And I think the Australian community can expect us to continue to do that. We'll also focus on, you know, one of the great problems confronting the nation, which is the energy transition. Mm-hmm. CSIRO does a lot of work to help build a system that is reliable, that is affordable, and that is sustainable for the nation.
Just before I let you go, I mean, you're not giving us a lot of details about exactly what you're going to be focusing on and exactly what you've been cutting. I mean, you've explained why. This has sparked a broader conversation in the federal parliament, I think, in sections of the country about how much we value research and development. How would you rank Australia's investment in research compared to comparable countries around the world?
I think it's well recognised over the last 40 years our investment in R&D as a nation has declined in a way that's very worrying. That's both from the viewpoint of private sector investment, but also government investment in R&D. So it's not a problem that has occurred over the last few years. It's something that's accumulated as a nation for decades. And I think it's a bit of a wake-up call. We need to think about what sort of nation we want to be.
Dr. Doug Hilton, CEO of the CSIRO, speaking with James Glenday. The organisation has said it will continue research on energy, critical minerals, climate change adaption, as well as agricultural technology on farm and biosecurity.
Corbin Middlemass here. This summer is all about the Ashes. To stay across every angle, join me and Ed Cowan on ABC Cricket Podcast, Monday and Friday and after every day of play. Search for ABC Cricket Podcast on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
A group of farmers, shearers and other locals from around the Dark Peak region of Eastern Eyre Peninsula have gotten their gear off. But it's all right. It's all for a good cause. They will feature in a calendar which has been described as tasteful but a bit naughty, raising funds for local projects funded by the Dark Peak Community Fund. With carefully placed tools, cricket bats and shearing handpieces, it's all been a bit of a laugh for those involved. Farmer Jamie Pearson, who took part in the photo shoot, told Brooke Neindorf where the idea came from.
Well, we've got a community fund set up. It's been running for a while now. And the committee on it last year, we had a bit of fun. We did a bit of a fun calendar for some random photos from around the hotel. And then we did a nice one with some landscapey type shots of the area or whatever. And people put some stuff in and we could buy them. And then it happened over a committee meeting in the hotel that someone suggested maybe we do a proper fun calendar with some people out of the community and see how we went with that. And so it sort of grew some legs from there, and we asked a few people whether they'd be interested in it. Honestly surprised me how interested people were in getting their gear off.
I was going to ask, did it take much convincing?
Most people were pretty good. A few people took a little bit of convincing, but once we told them sort of where the funds are going to and what goes in, it all goes back into our community, all the stuff 100%. So everyone was pretty happy in the end and was all taken very tastefully. So, it wasn't too tricky once we explained what we were up to. So,
now, Jamie, I have seen your photo. Do you want to explain Do you want to explain how yours is set up for the listeners?
I've got a round baler. I've got Carrapy Hill in the background. We thought we'd get a nice backdrop, hopefully take some focus off of me, but that obviously didn't work that well. And so, yeah, I've just kicked up there behind a round bale that's been kicked out the back of a round baler with not much except my hat to cover a lot. I've got my boots on, so you can't see me sock tan.
good safety there with the boots on.
Yeah, it was. Safety first, always.
And what about some of the other photos as well that have been taken? I believe there's a wide range of locals involved, from shearers to farmers to even the local cricket club.
Yeah, so we've tried to keep everyone sort of doing what they sort of do around the community. So I've got a baler. We've got a couple of boys and my brother's in there. He's doing a bit of shearing, I suppose, and we've got some wool handling going on in one of them. And then there's the cricket club. We're out there on the oval. That's a very interesting one. We've got the golf club involved as well. There's a lot of the money that comes out of our fundraising group goes into the local clubs around the area if they need something or whatever. Like, happy to get asked to donate a bit of money towards these things that pop up. So we sort of hit them up to get involved as well. And probably they were the ones that took the most convincing, and they're probably the better looking ones out of all of us. But some of them young lads weren't real keen on showing everybody. So
I was going to ask, was there going to be someone that was jumping in straight away that you knew you wouldn't have to convince?
We've got Harry Dunn and Wade Mason in there, and they, I don't know even why he called them, but he was very keen, Harry, to get his gear off and grab his putter and show a bit of skin. So that was all good. And then I didn't take much convincing, but I'd had a few beers by the time I got asked, so that helped. And by the time I'd asked a few people, we'd try to make sure they were lubricated, shall we say.
And
so, but
And obviously, Jamie, something like this, a lot of fun, but as you've mentioned, they're going towards a good cause. Is it, obviously in small communities, hard to try and raise funds for project in the town, but this sounds like it's been quite popular and already the orders have been huge.
Yeah, we've got a fair few. It's taken off a little bit more than I even expected. I thought it'd stay fairly local and just a bit of fun locally, but obviously with it getting out in the paper and then an interview, it's we've getting a few orders from not locally, so well done to everyone getting on board. But we're pretty lucky. We've got a really good community here, and if we get asked to do something or we've got some sheep to shear or fundraising type things, we all seem to get behind it and get it done. We've got a poll up at our sporting club that we look after pretty much ourselves at the moment, so it takes a fair bit to put some money into that. But it's not just this committee, between the sporting clubs, if we need to get something done, we generally get it sorted out pretty well. But it's just handy some of those smaller things to do. The local player group wanted some money for a new cubby house for the kids to do stuff, and it's a letter and it's a thing, and it just makes it a bit easier on some of those other committees as well, if they know there's a bit of something there. But yeah, try and make it a bit of fun while we're doing it and raise a bit of money for the crew around the joint. So,
and I guess also a bit of fun as well. Farming hasn't been the easiest job at the moment, and communities have been affected by the recent weather and drought conditions as well. So I guess this adds to, gets a bit of spirit back in the town as well.
Yeah, for sure. It's been a pretty long 12 months up here between feeding sheep and doing stuff over most of the year and the late start. So it was definitely, I cut around when I did my photo, we did the cricket club and Teddy Roberts on his header and the Sheeran boys. It was a very enjoyable afternoon to get everyone around and socialise a bit as well and have a good laugh at ourselves more than anything. It was a lot of laughs had, especially by the end of the evening. But so it's been really good on that side of things. So, and Georgie Nagel, that took all our photos, whatever, she's been brilliant to set everything up. And we thought we'd, instead of just doing some iPhones and locals, we'd get someone professional in to make it look a little bit like we know what we're doing. So, yeah, she was great too.
And Jamie, before I let you go, how is harvest going up around the Dark Peak region?
Slowly at this stage, Brooke. It's for the season we had and the rainfall at times and what it looked like by the end of June with some of the wind that we'd had, to be getting what we're getting, I'm really happy with. I'm not going to complain at all. So there's still a bit there. Where it's good, it looks like it's really good, and where it's bad, it's obviously pretty bad, where it blew early and it hasn't quite got over it. But it's looking, yeah, well, we should get something back, not too, a lot more than what I thought I was going to get 6 weeks ago anyway. So we've only done a couple hundred hectares of barley at this stage, and a lot of that got grazed early for sheep feed once it came up to try and let our pastures get away. But to be able to go out there and still get some stuff off of it, it definitely is a added bonus that I did not expect we'd be getting sort of September. So, yeah.
And just finally, Jamie, how many people in your family and friends group are getting the calendar for Christmas?
There's a fair few going out there. By the look of it on the pre-order thing on Facebook, I don't look like I'm going to actually have to buy too many for anyone myself. So that's a bonus. But, I think we're up over 150 pre-orders now, and so that's helped us sort of pick up some numbers and do whatever. And hopefully, I think they're getting ordered properly tomorrow once they're finalised, and hoping to have them here for the start of December to start getting out, so they're definitely out before Christmas. So yeah, that's hopefully everyone enjoys it as much as we enjoyed making it. So it definitely, I've had a sneak peek while we were setting it up, and it's definitely very, 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 very good.
Dark Peak farmer Jamie Pearson speaking with Brooke Nindorf. And yes, good luck to the group. I hope there's strong demand and the calendar flies off the shelves. Now we better check in on the Mount Compass market before we finish up today with Brooke Nindorf. Hi, Brooke.
Hi, Elsie. Numbers reduced as agents offered 509 live weight and open auction cattle. Quality was again extremely mixed, however, more finished cattle were on offer. The usual trade and processor buyers were active, with one export cow buyer absent. Specialty butchers, feeders and restockers operated on suitable lines with generally good competition. Light Velas were in demand with calves to 280 kilos live weight, breaking the 600 cents mark as the top sold to 635 cents a kilo. Vela steers sold from 411 to 635 cents as heifers ranged from 343 to 491 cents a kilo. Yearling steers sold 10 cents a kilo dearer as they ranged from 363 to 507 cents with heifers fetching 445 to 489 cents a kilo. The best of the grown steers sold up to 25 cents a kilo dearer as they sold from 455 to 495 cents with heifers gaining 15 cents a kilo as they sold from 417 to 487 cents a kilo. Medium beef cows ranged from 340 to 403 cents as dairy breeds sold from 250 to 280 cents. Heavy beef cows sold 5 to 10 cents a kilo dearer as they ranged from 350 to 457 cents with dairy breeds fetching 305 to 380 cents a kilo. Bulls sold from 369 to 450 cents a kilo. And these numbers have been provided by John Traeger for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thanks for that, Brooke. That was Brooke Nindorf with the Mount Compass Market Report. Now that's all we have time for the Country Hour today. Thank you so much for your company. Now, quick note for the program tomorrow, the Ashes are starting, which means that if you tune in at midday, you'll hear our ABC cricket coverage. So to listen into the Country Hour, you need to head online, search for the South Australian Country Hour to find our live stream or open up your ABC Listen app. I've been Elsie Adamo. The Rural Team will be back tomorrow, as I said, streaming online. It is coming up to your 1 o'clock news headlines.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.